65 to the west for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of today's program talking about one of the most vexing challenges confronting many cities across the United States: violence and violent crime, and how to reduce it. It is a problem that is often badly misunderstood by the general public. Some of us who are blessed to live in relatively safe neighborhoods might be tempted to think of this as a problem that affects others. That is, it's not our problem, it has nothing to do with us. When in fact, the scourge of violence, if it affects any part of our community, affects all of us to one extent or another. Many of us find ourselves gravitating towards rather simplistic solutions that will come at no cost to us. When in fact, to combat violence and violent crime in a meaningful way means that there must be a comprehensive effort involving essentially every aspect of our community. In August of 2023, Racine Mayor Corey Mason appointed John Tate II to be the Violence Prevention Manager for the Office of Violence Prevention. And now Mr. Tate serves as Director of the Department of Community Safety for the City of Racine. I was privileged to record an interview yesterday morning with Mr. Tate to find out some of the work that he has been doing, he and his colleagues, on this really important issue. John Tate II has been a visible member of the community for some time, a former Racine alderman, a former president of the Racine Common Council, and former chair of the Wisconsin Parole Board, with a professional background in social work and individual and family therapy. In our wide-ranging conversation, we talk, among other things, about the distinction between public safety and community safety. We also explored some of the ways in which the City of Racine is working in partnership with Racine County and the Racine Unified School District to help bring about some meaningful change with this very important issue. John Tate II, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Gregory. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really happy that we can have this opportunity. Since it is your first visit, I think it would be great for us to learn a little bit more about you. And I think people know your name well as someone who has been active in the City of Racine for some time. Remind us, first of all, is Racine your hometown? Is this where you have always been?
Well, not always. I was born in California when my dad was stationed there in the military, but raised here because my mother's from here. Her family's from here. So about 1 year old and on, I've been here. But I don't have the privilege of saying I was born and raised in Racine. It wouldn't be accurate, but I have been. It is my hometown, yes.
And you're about as born and raised in Racine as one can be without not quite doing it. So tell us, for instance, where you grew up exactly in Racine, the schools you went to, the kind of things that kept you busy as a young man.
No. Thanks for asking. So I grew up on the south side, 21st and Grand, now Caron Butler and Grand. Often spending time at the John Bryant Center. Went to elementary school right around the corner from my house at Stephen Bull Fine Arts, which is no longer around the corner on DeCoven Avenue. I think it's located somewhere else within the city.
And what drew you to Stephen Bull Fine Arts? I mean, why did you and or your parents want you to go there?
I believe at the time, and it still is, a magnet school, or what's referred to as a magnet school. So even though it was definitely my community school, as we would understand it today, it was not a school that we automatically would have been enrolled in. So my mother, I think very intentionally, I'm not sure what the process was, but she may have like camped out overnight or whatever the process was at the time to kind of get me enrolled there. I think both for convenience, but also because of the reputation of having that multidisciplinary arts-enriching education that I think a lot of my classmates who I see today have certainly benefited from. So
is this something that you genuinely, personally were interested in? I mean, were you an artistically minded kid or not particularly?
I wouldn't say in particular. I mean, this would have been first grade, so I'm not sure what kind of interests many of us had. I think the main objective was to provide as much and as broad of opportunities for my educational experience as possible. From then, my mother actually enrolled me in the Prairie School. So from middle school through high school, I went to Prairie and Wind Point, but still always lived in the South Side. So there were some times where, you know, if I needed to get home and there wasn't a ride, I'd, you know, catch the bus, you know, bus number 2 or number 7 sometimes. Or sometimes I'd just hike it and, you know, actually walk, you know, the distance between Racine and Wind Point and kind of see a lot of things that a lot of my peers maybe didn't because, you know, being on the South Side, there's a tradition or at least a mindset of like, you don't go to the north side or, you know, you stick to your particular side of town. And that just wasn't a possibility for me because literally my school was on the other side of town.
So I had
to navigate certain areas regardless of where I was from.
Wow. Interesting. So as a young man growing up, what were the things that you ended up being interested in and devoting a lot of your time to?
A lot of youth sports, very imaginative. I remember my dad worked for DPW. So he was a garbage man for, you know, the for the early years of my life in elementary and middle school. So he'd often bring things home from the route, kind of like the TV show Rock. So sometimes he would, I don't know how he found it, but he found a tetherball pole once, found baseball pads. So I would often gather kids in the neighborhood to play sports and activities because we had stuff that usually people didn't because he was finding it on the route somewhere where somebody was discarding it. So that was a very much a portion of my childhood growing up, was a convener in some ways of the youth in the neighborhood because I had the stuff because my dad found the stuff. So we were constantly repurposing things and making more out of what we had or what we didn't have because of just the opportunities that were, you know, he took advantage of during his time and just finding value in things that otherwise, you know, perhaps others did not. So
that's great. I love that. So as you found your way into high school, what hints would there be, if any, that of kind of the trajectory that your life would take in terms of being someone interested in serving the community in a lot of different ways? I mean, would we have already seen hints of that at Prairie School, or did that emerge a little later in full-fledged adulthood?
I can probably attribute my desire to want to do, you know, human service work, people-serving work, helping profession work to my experience growing up with my sister. She had some challenges in related to the criminal justice system, you know, having fights at school and other challenging situations. Eventually, she was adjudicated to Lincoln Hills. So that sort of disruption that occurred within my family's life, in addition to my relationship with her and kind of talking, and when we shared a room at the time, talking at night and about the things that she was going through and the challenges she was experiencing as somebody 4 years older than me, and me having to think about those things and want to hear about those things and kind of reflect back what her experiences were, kind of shaped me and conditioned me to be a person who wants to listen and understand. But also solve problems, really significant problems. And obviously, she's not obviously, but she's in a much better place today, still alive. But, you know, things have worked out. But I think that was my first orientation. This is probably when I'm 10, 11, 12 years old. To be oriented to like just this very disruptive, you know, challenging emotional scenarios for both my family and my sibling. And having to learn to navigate that and internalize how to deal with that sort of stuff. And that eventually translates into my career and what I kind of the path I wanted to take. Even in high school, I recognized that I want to kind of go into social work or therapy or something to that end. There wasn't necessarily, I mean, high school doesn't necessarily offer like, at least not a lot of them offer like therapeutic classes or psychology, unless, you know, you're an AP or something to that effect. But that was very much something that I was rooted in early on and ultimately pursued throughout my career.
Great. Where did you end up going to college? I know you ended up going into individual and family therapy. And did you Were you schooled in that specifically at college?
Yeah, I went to Marquette for my undergraduate. I started enrolled in 2004. Part of my motivation, to be fair, was 2003 was the Final Four run.
Ah.
So I was like, okay, if I'm deciding here, maybe I think I want to stay local. But, you know, we've got some competitive basketball happening here, too. So I went to Marquette, majored in sociology, minored in psychology. The decision there was essentially which classes I was enjoying the most at the time.
Yeah.
It was going to go either way. But sociology ended up being a lot more interesting. And probably you can imagine as I'm dealing with systems and social behavior today and understanding how people behave as groups and in their individual capacities, that sociology degree continues to pay dividends, per se.
Hmm.
But unfortunately, in a lot of cases, an undergraduate degree in either sociology or psychology doesn't necessarily position a person to kind of engage in that work in a really explicit way. So a master's degree is often required. But I didn't pursue that until about 10 years into my career, or probably 8 years into my career, where I was working in mental health services, residential treatment in a youth facility for young adults and individuals, children in Illinois, aged, you know, as young as 6, as old as 21, with significant mental health challenges and behavioral disorders and developmental disabilities. So that's where I applied my initial undergraduate degree, and probably about midway through that time there, I chose to return to graduate school to get my master's in social work.
You were telling me, from Loyola.
Chicago.
At Carthage, mm-hmm. but through Loyola University.
Yeah.
Very good.
Which was a fantastic program. Obviously, since the time I did that, virtual schooling has become quite in vogue. But at the time, it was a two-year program every Saturday for 2 years straight at the Carthage campus, taking those master's level classes. It was an incredible experience. The cohort that we came out of, many are doing fantastic things across this state and country. And I do miss the fact that it doesn't exist in person anymore, but I'm sure it exists in a virtual form.
Right, yeah. So. Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Tate II, and it's his first visit to the morning show. He is the violence prevention manager for the city of Racine in their Office of Violence Prevention. So,
that's a correction.
Oh.
Yeah. The department is now the Department of Community Safety.
Ah.
Sorry.
Great. Thank you for
I'm the director of that. That transitioned in last year's budget.
Great. So. Thank you for the correction. So for the Office of Community Safety. Very good.
Department.
Department.
Sorry.
There we go. All right. I think we got it right now. Great. You eventually, of course, became an alderman and I think for a time served as president of the Racine Common Council. Was that a very natural sort of procession from what you had done before or progression or did that feel like kind of a dramatic leap into something different?
So part of the inspiration for me going to get my master's degree was a recognition that policy decisions were being made from a governmental level that were directly and probably negatively impacting the children that I was working with, particularly the young adults who were transitioning from the youth system to the adult system because the resources dropped off precipitously that were available for them. So when I understood that was a decision being made at a governmental level of priorities being made, I recognized that, you know, clearly someone should be advocating for these individuals and many others who otherwise aren't being heard or being recognized or prioritized in the way that someone who's working directly with individuals sees that it needs to be prioritized. So that's part of what inspired me to pursue a master's degree, because at the time, and this was 2014, in my mind, I was thinking, well, I should get some qualifications if I want to run for public office. So getting an advanced degree was part of that for me. So after I got my degree, it happened sooner than I anticipated. But I certainly did intend to want to run for office and serve my community in some capacity, using that education and experience to the benefit of the community.
Fantastic. What was it like to find yourself then in that arena?
Yeah.
Was it what you expected it to be? Were there pleasures and or frustrations that you did not necessarily anticipate?
I mean, being a social worker, that means that I am familiar with navigating unpleasant and not always ideal circumstances. So when I encourage, when I talk to younger people who are either thinking about government or, you know, discussing what kind of degrees they pursue, and if there's some sort of overlap, I can't emphasize enough that social work is a fantastic degree for anybody who wants to go into government, because you are required to understand individual experiences and systemic experiences and what an individual's experience is within those systems. So the application to governing and government is like almost one to one.
Wow.
But the experience of like running for office or being in government, I mean, it was just dealing with the issues that you're presented with and hoping that you can improve the outcomes for those that are under who you are representing. But yeah, I mean, there's always tension and disagreements, but I've always found myself to be somebody who is embracing of disagreements, because I think that's a beneficial process to kind of let's put your ideas on the table, and then let's talk about it, and then also let's remain focused on the actual task at hand. That's something that I saw a few times while on council, is just the deviation from like, this is the subject we're talking about, and it starts drifting into another area, and it's like, let's come on back. That's fine. We can talk about that, you know, outside of this, but this is the particular subject, and trying to remain on task, which sounds very teacher-like, but it's kind of necessary because governance and governing and political conversations can very easily drift into areas that are not necessarily relevant to the subject at the time. So I did enjoy when I was as council president, kind of reeling us back in at times, saying, okay, like, this is a good conversation. I appreciate the passion behind it, but this is what we're talking about. Yep. Let's make sure we're on that.
That picture of herding cats comes to mind when it comes to those situations.
I would never, never describe my colleagues on council as cats.
But the frustration can be maybe comparable. So anyway, I think you described that well. I know that for a time you served on the Wisconsin Parole Board. And I suspect that there is more than a little bit of connection between that experience and what you are doing now in terms of the whole sphere of violence prevention. Can you just speak briefly about your time on the state parole board?
Sure. So it was certainly a pleasure to have been appointed by Governor Evers at the time to serve as parole chair. I think the charge at the time was to apply the principles of both redemption, as we share in our community and I think in society in general, to want to give people the opportunities that they've earned for second chances, but also applying that data-driven, data-informed perspective of how do we know when someone has reduced their risk satisfactorily to return to the community? How do we know when a person who may have committed some serious harm no longer requires this level of intervention, which prison being the highest level of intervention we can apply to anyone in this pretty much world, but particularly in this country, as far as restriction of freedom of movement and those sorts of things. So it was kind of applying those sorts of principles and trying to be very deliberate in recognizing, you know, who the individuals are as individuals, against the harm that they previously had caused, and ultimately who they are today, you know, often 20, 25, 30 years removed from the harm that they caused. So it was certainly a pleasure to operate in that space and apply some of those principles. And, you know, today see, you know, people walking around who were released under my tenure, living fruitful, productive lives and impacting their communities in positive ways. But I think the piece that kind of directly ties from being parole chair to this current work is I had the opportunity to sit before a lot of men and women who had directly and negatively impacted lives, harmed people significantly, usually often through forms of violence and gun violence, and hearing their stories of how they became the person who would commit that kind of harm, what they recognized as could have been different or what they needed to be different in their lives in order not to commit that harm, and how many of them wanted to take their negative impact, what they did, the harm they caused, and turn it into something beneficial if they were given the opportunity to return home. And I think many of them want to work in spaces where they're directly working with people who are on the same course as them before they make the same choices as they did. So that experience certainly dovetails right into this work, because I have at least some perspectives of individuals who have committed harm. So we know how to at least have a sense of how to reach those who are on that course and perhaps how we can deviate them from those actions before it occurs. So
that reminds me of something I read Mayor Corey Mason saying, I think at the time of the creation of what was the Office of Violence Prevention, as you said, now the Department of Community Safety, right. But Mayor Mason saying that there were three things that really needed to be part of this initiative: solving crimes, preventing crimes, and then the third, which I think speaks to what you're talking about, addressing root causes. Yeah. And he went on to say, one human being at a time. I mean, that's really the way in which that is accomplished. So I know it was through a substantial grant that this Office of Violence Prevention was first created, and from the start, what has been kind of the primary impetus for that? I mean, what kind of reality are we talking about to which this office was created to combat that?
So I think in 2022, when virtually everybody, Racine and everyone else across this country, was experiencing spikes, not necessarily historical, because I think we've never quite reached, you know, things like in the mid-90s, but certainly spikes for the modern era of crime and violence, and in also response to, I think, the destabilization that came across society with the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I think we really don't speak to that enough as far as, like, why are these things happening? So I think Governor Evers and many others, and even the American Rescue Plan funds, all recognize that the secondary and tertiary impacts of the pandemic were directly contributing to these spikes in violence and crime throughout the country. And it's hard to argue otherwise when everyone's experienced this destabilizing event, and this is the results happening in so many places.
Yeah.
It's not unique to anywhere. So I think it's a very reasonable conclusion for those policymakers to say, like, this is a outcome of the pandemic, so the recovery funds should be applied to that. So Governor Evers recognized, one, that the city needed support, so we offered both funds to assist with law enforcement overtime, because obviously when things are happening, you need emergency responses, but also to recognize that there's more to this than just how we respond. So we want to provide some resources to help establish a mechanism by which you can deal with the things further upstream and deal with some of those root causes, which she offered, I think, roughly $250,000 to establish the office and initiate a comprehensive safety plan or blueprint similar to what exists in Milwaukee, the 41 for Life plan. So those were the initial funds that were released to the city. Subsequently, the city also was able to secure, I think, $1.5 million for over 3 years for from the Medical College of Wisconsin's Wisconsin Community Safety Funds, which also was funded by ARPA dollars, to further establish the departments and particular plans for intervention. So this year, we're actually using all of those funds exactly as they were determined. This summer we'll be going through and developing our comprehensive community safety plan by conducting numerous community conversations. I hope folks will stand by for about mid-June. We'll start announcing and holding those across the community, wanting to meet with various groups that already exist, whether that's block clubs, neighborhood groups, business groups. We'll want to coordinate and join for those meetings and have those conversations if we're allowed to join. Otherwise, we'll also be organizing and hosting our own meetings, but essentially trying to get as many voices from the city as possible to hear what their particular perspective is on safety. How do they define safety for themselves, their families, their communities? How do they define community? And then also ultimately using that feedback of what people are determining, what makes them feel safe, what defines safety for them, to shape what our priorities are as a city, and then recognize where those priorities fit for every single department to have a role to play. So safety isn't just a matter of police and fire. Safety is a matter of public works. Safety is a matter of water. Safety is a matter of parks and recreation. Every governmental entity has a part to play in fostering a safe community for our residents. And not just governmental entities, but those priorities will also perhaps influence or at least have some perspective on what our non-governmental partners should be doing, our nonprofit sectors, our private sector partners, so that we can advocate and say, this is what we've heard from our residents, this is what we've heard from our citizens that say, this is what defines safety for them. What role do you think you have to play as a employer? What role do you think you can play as a nonprofit provider? Here's what we think you could be doing, or here's how we think things could be different based on the feedback that we've gotten from our residents, and ultimately recognize that everybody, you know, from the individual to the government, to the private sector, to the employer, has a role to play in fostering a safe community. And then kind of championing that plan, carrying that plan forward, and then being the collaborator that brings these folks and individuals and organizations together to ultimately meet those needs that our residents have said they want.
Right. So one of the things you're pointing to is that this is about something much bigger than just law enforcement. This is not just something that in which we want to work with the police to figure out how can they be even more effective in dealing with combating, preventing crime and violence and so on. This is about trying to enact something that is far more comprehensive than that.
Yeah.
And as you and I were talking a couple of days ago in preparation for this interview, one of the things you mentioned that we should probably spend at least a couple of minutes talking about is some terminology, namely community safety.
Yeah.
And public safety, or community safety versus public safety. And you were saying just before we went on the air, it's not a matter of either or. It's not a choice. But nevertheless, it's two ways of thinking about safety that are a bit distinct from each other. Explain what that distinction or difference is between community safety versus public safety.
Yeah. So I think in general, for a lot of community sentiment, or people in the community sentiment, public safety is well defined as the response to emergency services or response to emergency incidents. And I think that's okay and that's necessary and that's, you know, reasonable. I think police and fire are generally are recognized as public safety. They respond to instances when things have destabilized and need an immediate intervention, and they will come and address that issue and restore stability and safety to that area, or on the police side, hold whomever has destabilized safety to that area accountable. Community safety, our objective is to kind of orient ourselves to the safety of the community from through a public health lens. So that means we're obviously not operating in the realm of law, but we're operating in the realm of, you know, public health and human developments and our understanding of social and psychological behaviors, and creating plans, interventions around those pieces. So that does mean that when we consider what the root causes are, we're trying to understand what leads a person to engage in certain activities, what factors contribute to someone getting to the place where they are violating law or violating others' rights, and how, and if we can understand those variables, then how can we influence those variables so that don't occur in that fashion, former fashion. So our response isn't necessarily on the accountability side of stopping someone or holding someone accountable after they've done a thing, but recognizing what contributes to a person doing a thing and how do we interrupt those particular variables or get a hold of that person and then deviate them from that particular path. So we do have examples that we're actually developing and deploying right now that I could speak to, but we can go into that a little bit further
later. So I would think that, you know, in the matter of what drives people to this kind of behavior, I'm guessing that there's not much of a mystery there. And obviously this is something we've been wrestling with for a long time. So I suspect that what you're talking about in this moment is not figuring this out.
Right.
I mean, answering this question, I suspect what you're talking about is going further and maybe parsing out what are the ways in which this community, its systems on that sort of systemic level, or maybe inadvertently, unintentionally, sparking this kind of behavior and contributing to what you've just been describing.
Yeah. I mean, there are certainly sociological and psychological factors that heavily correlate, meaning like one-to-one, if this is there, then this is also probably going to happen or this is also going to be there. So that's, yes, when you kind of say we're not figuring out, we kind of know, like if there's concentrated poverty, if there's generational concentrated poverty, if there's experience of significant and deep trauma, if there is availability to weapons or firearms, if there's easy access, like all of these are like very clear indicators and
addiction
variables.
Addiction, also.
Yes, substance abuse, which is also a outgrowth of traumatic experiences. Like where these things concentrate and coalesce, you're probably going to see some pretty significant violence as well. And I think the important thing about emphasizing that particular dynamic is recognizing that that can be anybody in those circumstances. It's not necessarily a moral failure of an individual when they face concentrated poverty, trauma, drug abuse, destabilized social relationships, that these are the things that ultimately happen. Because that, you know, as my father often says, but by the grace of God, there go I. So when we do that, when we think of that perspective, we also kind of take back some of our judgment per se, or like you did this because you're this horrible person, as opposed to you did this because you've got these horrible circumstances. Yes, you did this, so accountability is necessary, but also if we can prevent others who've got those same circumstances from making that choice and changing their circumstances, then why wouldn't we do that? Because the reality is, if these things exist, these are probably going to be the outcomes. If we're not addressing those, then we're also not really championing for victims who might be potential victims, because we know these are things that are going to happen because these variables exist.
Right.
So for the sake of those who might be harmed and those who have been harmed, it's almost incumbent upon us to address those things before they occur, because we know this is how the things go.
Right. And of course, one reason why plenty of people, I would count myself among them, feel drawn to a simpler model of here's this bad person over here with their moral failings who succumbed to temptation and did this terrible thing, and let's lock them up or give them treatment or both or whatever. But there is a simplicity to that, that this happened because this person did this thing. And it's more complicated to think about the world in which that person lived and all of the influences that helped guide them towards that scenario. And so you're talking about asking people to be willing to pull back from the wrongdoer and to look at the systems in which they live and have learned and so on. So it's something big that you and your colleagues are taking on.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we're certainly asking people to pull back. It's not an either or that accountability isn't essential. It is. It's both and. It's accountability and prevention. It's accountability and systems change. It's accountability and, you know, dealing with the underlying circumstances. Because I think it's unreasonable to say, like, well, this person did this thing because they had all these horrible experiences. So, oh, well, we're not going to, you know, hold that person accountable. It's like, no, like, if harm has occurred, like, accountability is necessary. It's just we can't be in a place where we conclude that that accountability happened in a vacuum or that that behavior happened in a vacuum. We all had a piece, you know, and I say we societally, we all had a piece to play in how that person came to where they were. And that certainly doesn't apply to everything, but in more than not, it does. So if that's the case, then we have, you know, a societal responsibility, a governmental responsibility to want to do more to address those circumstances.
You just mentioned the word government, and I want to make sure that I take a second to ask you about the relationship between your efforts with the city of Racine and efforts that are underway with Racine County and what I believe is the Violent Crime Reduction Initiative at the county level. Can you just explain the relationship, if any, between your efforts and theirs? Is there overlap? Is there conflict, in what way are you at all cooperating or at least aware of each other's efforts?
Thank you so much for bringing that up. So the Violent Crime Reduction Initiative is actually a collaborative. It's largely convened and led by the county, but it's really a collaborative between the city of Racine, the county of Racine County, and Racine Unified School District. So we are very much well integrated in pretty much all of our efforts, whether county staff or city staff who are operating in this violence prevention community safety space are actively and regularly coordinating our efforts in both developing plans and providing outreach to the community and engaging in services. Like pretty much while we're not a single entity, we are very much entwined with one another and how we operate and what we're accomplishing, both so that we don't duplicate processes because there's more than enough work to be done within our community, but two, so that we're not, you know, interfering with each other's lane either as we've, you know, kind of collectively decided what we're going to do in either deploying particular strategies or just building a shared understanding about how we approach these issues. So I think one of the things that virtually everybody who's working together has kind of oriented ourselves as was a book by Thomas Apt called Bleeding Out. It pretty much details the experience of the sociological assessment of, like, how do people end up engaging in group-related gun violence, and then how do you interrupt that? And that was kind of the orientation that everybody in the VCRI kind of came to the conversation, understanding that, yes, there's absolutely accountability, and yes, there's a law enforcement response to when people shoot, and there's a whole lot of issues that are occurring that we can be getting ahead of and addressing and understanding better and orienting our resources so that we can reduce the prevalence of these particular outcomes. The VCRI is very much still in existence. Very much we meet regularly to discuss progress, programming, activities, and collaborative opportunities, and just continue to foster a working relationship with one another. As, you know, governmental bodies, and recognizing that each of us, similar to the comprehensive plan that I referred, has a piece to play in our respective roles, but that is can't be independent, or it can't be separate, or it can't be siloed, which is often the challenge for our community is the siloing of resources and efforts. And this is an attempt to both operate independently, but also not silo what we're trying to do, and then ultimately collaborate with how those independent operations flow together. So certainly, I think at another time, perhaps the violence prevention manager on the county side, Maurice Horton, who's also an alder, could join us. We can both talk about kind of what we've been doing together and what the impacts are, and kind of we're really, you know, in these last several months have been operationalizing, you know, how we're working together and, you know, sharing information and communicating so that we can address issues as they're arising kind of in real time. Similar to law enforcement, as they're kind of doing their intelligence, we're trying to address that in a different way on a different side before it becomes a thing that requires, you know, that intervention or demands that level of accountability.
So. Right. Absolutely. I think you're speaking to a reality that's becoming increasingly clear, which is that a farm is the only place where there should be a silo, that in government, in law enforcement, in public health, in industry, in higher education, in any kind of education, silos are almost always counterproductive. And even though there might be something sort of immediately comforting about being in a nice little silo, it is almost never a good idea. Briefly, we just have a few minutes left. I don't remember if I was reading about your particular office or the county-wide initiative, but the words violence interruption model leapt out at me. And I'm just curious if that's terminology you're familiar with.
Might be referring to the group violence intervention strategy.
But it's, you know, it said interruption. It said violence interruption model.
Okay.
But I mean, it occurs to me, you know, however one might use that terminology, that in a sense, that's what this is about.
Right.
You're trying to interrupt what sometimes turns out to be a tremendously destructive and even deadly cycle.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're trying to do that at a number of different levels.
Yes. Yes. I think an important piece, or at least a kind of jarring reality we have to recognize, is there is a response to violence that is legal, that is appropriate. We're a nation of laws, so as it should be, but that response doesn't always necessarily end that particular cycle. Mm. You know, even if someone is arrested, prosecuted, they might not be convicted. And in that instance, the attempt to interrupt that particular violence through the legal means, you know, can't be pursued. And if that's the reality, then we still need to stop that cycle from occurring.
Yep.
So that's kind of a lot of what this work is recognizing that, yes, if people are being dangerous, if people are committing harm, there is absolutely a law enforcement response. There's absolutely a legal response that should be processed through and executed. And in that reality still occurring, there is still potential for violence to occur. And how do we address that? How do we interrupt that? Because it's not okay for those things to continue to progress even as the legal process proceeds forth. A prime example of this is, I think earlier this year, there was a prosecution for a charge with homicide for a young person who was accused of killing another young person. That case ended in an acquittal. And in the midst of that case proceeding, there were the violence prevention team working with the respective sides to ensure that an escalation would not occur as this case was proceeding. That's not a legal response.
Right.
That's not a law enforcement response. That is a space that is occupied by those who are doing violence intervention work outside of the strictly legal lane. And it's absolutely essential, because who knows if that work isn't happening, it's very much within the realm of probability that particular case going forth, as it does, being group-related, being a retaliatory sort of event, explodes, and we have another cycle continue.
Absolutely.
So without that particular intervention of Maurice Horton and his team on the county side, engaging and building relationships with those who are involved in this and using those relationships to foster a safer outcome for everybody involved, even if the legal outcome was not what was desired at the end of it, at least for, you know, those who lost their loved one and wanted accountability, that instance did not turn into something exponentially worse because of those interventions. And that's, I'm glad you kind of mentioned that, and I kind of was able to bring up that piece, because that's what makes it so hard to, and this is what's going to be a challenge going forward in this field in general, is how to measure the impact of something not happening.
Right.
But that's a prime example, and it ends up being a lot of anecdotal stuff, unfortunately, because it's hard to measure the absence of an event. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly what it does, is when you have people who are in relationships, have a different orientation to the individuals that are at the highest risk, and are able to use those relationships to foster a safer outcome, to deviate or derail, you know, certain choice pathways and options, and have them choose something else. This is what we are able to do, is that people who otherwise, absent of that intervention, would likely have done what we expected them to do, don't. Hmm. And now we have no shootings being born out of that, no additional homicides being born out of that, because these things are exponentially growing when they are, particularly for these retaliatory ones. So I think that's just a prime example of what violence intervention can be and what its impact will be when we kind of truly support it and allow those who are trying to do that particular work to continue to do that work.
Mm. John Tate II is director of the Department of Community Safety for the city of Racine. As was mentioned in the interview, there will be public meetings and forums on this important topic beginning in the middle of June. We will be announcing those on WGTD. And John Tate II is going to be coming back to the morning show in the relatively near future to talk, among other things, about the group violence initiative that is underway, a very important cornerstone of the work that is being done by the Department of Community Safety. My thanks to John Tate II for making time in his busy schedule to be my morning show guest today here on WGTD. Part two of today's morning show is from the Morning Show Archives. And I am so grateful to be able to have a few minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano, who is beloved to many for her part of Sesame Street for many years, with the beloved character Maria, but also the author of a number of wonderful books, including a memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. Her most recent book, her first book for National Geographic, is called A World Together. And this is a book that the world really needs. And it is a beautiful exploration of just what makes our world so beautiful and rich, and how in our diversity we find layers of beauty that we would otherwise never be able to see. And we have a couple of minutes to speak with Sonia Manzano about what inspired her to write this book, A World Together. Sonia Manzano, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. My pleasure to talk about the book. I jumped at the chance when National Geographic asked me to write a book about diversity, seeing as a state we find the world in today, and especially our country. I'm especially chagrined of the state of affairs, since I thought that Sesame Street had sort of solved all those problems in 1969 and the result of the civil rights movement and the idealism of President Johnson when he wanted to create the Great Society way back in the 70s. So if there's one thing I've learned, it's that just because you address a problem in one generation doesn't mean it's going to spill over into the coming generation. Mm. So it was time for a good book about sharing all the ways that we are the same, in that we feel sad and we feel happy and we all want shelter and we all feel hungry and we all are satisfied when we eat something good, are all the ways that we're the same part of the human condition. The only ways we're different is culturally, and those are the cultural things we should celebrate.
Mm. So explain to our listeners what they find in the pages of this book, both in your words, your lovingly crafted words, but also in the splendid visuals that are also part of this book.
Yes, Lori Epstein, the photo editor at National Geographic, did a smashing, wonderful job of showing all kinds of kids in all kinds of situations. I wanted some urban images, and she complied by having that wonderful image of the kids playing by a fire hydrant, because that was kind of my experience as a kid growing up in the Bronx. And I was also interested in not shying away from showing a sad image. And we have a picture of a looks like a soldier kissing his child goodbye. And the words that go with it say, "And when people feel scared, they sometimes forget that deep down we're all the same." Mm-hmm. And I suppose I'm reacting to the fact that I see so much anger out there more than I thought people felt, but clearly they do. And that must come out of fear, and we forget that we're the same. And that picture, coupled with those words, might inspire conversations in that direction or not. Or someone will just say, "Well, that's like just a sad picture," and leave it at that. So I hope it is a book that starts when you close the last page.
Mm. What do you think it is that keeps some people from embracing and celebrating this notion of our diversity? What is it that makes that to some people an idea that they just don't warm up to and maybe even feel even kind of repelled by or afraid of? What are people afraid of when it comes to diversity?
I don't know why people are afraid. I honestly don't, and I was struck by a quote. I want to say it was Carrie Mae Weems, but I don't know if she said that, an African-American artist. If it wasn't her, I apologize, but who said, I look in the mirror, but I don't see. What is so frightening? And those words stay with me. And, you know, I do a voice on an animated show for Nickelodeon where I play a Mexican grandmother. Now, it's very funny. I enjoy myself because they keep correcting my Puerto Rican Spanish. Because it's a little different. It's a little different. And the foods, you know, I'll have to pronounce foods that begin with the letter X. And I don't know how to pronounce them. So they'll help me with the pronunciation. But that doesn't frighten me that they're different. I enjoy it. It doesn't frighten me when I read Sherman Alexie books and I learn about Native American experience. It's curious. It's different from mine. It's when I read about a poor child on a reservation. I was a poor child in the Bronx, but they're very different experiences. And it just... I'm curious about it, not frightened. Hmm. I don't know why some people find any change in anyone's lifestyle or behavior so frightening. I'm at a loss.
In the last 20 seconds, what did you learn from all of your work on Sesame Street that helped you understand and appreciate diversity?
Humor. Humor will go very, very far. People will laugh at the same things. And I think that's why Sesame Street is such a success worldwide, because people will have a sense of humor and usually find the same things universally humorous.
Funny how laughter opens up the heart. And I love your book, A World Together, published by National Geographic. Sonia Manzano, thank you for giving it to the world.
Thank you so much. Stay well.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Andrea Sankar, co-author of a book called Dying at Home, A Guide for Caregivers. A really intriguing, thought-provoking book that really helps someone in that situation of caring for someone at the very end of life navigate through the many challenges that can be part of that experience. An experience that also can be tremendously beautiful and moving. On Thursday, the co-author of the book Being White Today, a book which explores the way in which one can live an anti-racist life in modern America. On Friday, the author of a novel called Force of Nature, based on the life of Rachel Carson. And we're going to hear from some of the cast of the current production at the Racine Theater Guild, the wonderful Candor and Ebb musical, Cabaret. Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast calls for skies to become partly sunny, but we are expecting more rainfall today, and some of it could be in the form of strong thunderstorms. We're headed for a high today of 80 degrees, a little cooler near the lake. Rain and thunderstorms are likely tonight, and some could be severe. Overnight low of 59 degrees. By tomorrow, Wednesday, sunny skies and a high of 73 degrees. Thursday, sunny and a high of 79. On Friday, partly sunny, but with a 40% chance of some rain developing. Very similar forecast for both Saturday and Sunday. Mild conditions, mostly sunny skies, but with a decent chance of rain. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to